official.
And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, but not such a great day in college campuses around the country, where some of America's most distinguished and lavishly supported universities and colleges have been racked with extreme protests, protests charging the Jewish people, and not just the state of Israel, but Jews everywhere, with genocide, mass murder, apartheid, all kinds of crimes. And those protesters identifying proudly and increasingly openly with the murderous terrorists of Hamas. What is the latest? And it's not just Columbia University anymore. It's everywhere. Harvard actually had a fairly good outcome, and it was through no virtue of the administration, which is in transition at Harvard in any event. We will get to that, and we will get to what was a extremely revealing effort by the Speaker of the House, who is looking more and more heroic and more credible. Mike Johnson has turned out to be the best thing that's happened to the Republican Party in the House of Representatives in a long time. He led a group of members of the House of Representatives to confront the protesters at Columbia University, and we'll play for you some audio of what that sounded like. Speaking of extreme divisions that harm the country, Jim Wallace has been a leader of what has been called the Christian left for many, many years. He now has a new best-selling book. It's already the number four book in the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction. It's a movie, probably won't be a movie. It's a book called The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. We'll speak to Jim Wallace about what he believes is the difference between what he calls the true faith and the false white gospel. And what does that have to do with anything more than attitudes toward racial agitation? Speaking of racial agitation, disastrous news for the United States. The U.S. fertility rate fell to a record low. Fewer babies were born in the U.S. in 2023 than any year since 1979. Is this just a reflection of COVID? Why is this such terrible news for the United States of America? We'll be speaking to Nick Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute about the economic and sociological and cultural impact of this decline in the fertility rate. And you'll notice that at the same time all this is going on, there are various courtrooms, at least three, that are actively pursuing elements of the charges against Donald Trump. He is present, of course, in Lower Manhattan in the hush money for porn stars case, which began to hear some fairly racy testimony today from David Pecker. It's his name, David Pecker, who is the former chief executive at National Enquirer, and who talks about Trump asking him specifically to shut down stories about some of Trump's romantic adventures, to use a euphemism. As President Trump also was involved, getting Pecker to run stories about Ted Cruz, which appear not to have been true, about his alleged romantic adventures. And remember, they were also responsible for that story claiming that Ted Cruz's father, Pastor Rafael Cruz, was involved in the Kennedy assassination, which was a complete lie. And again, doesn't make President Trump look particularly good. There's also a higher court that had been appealed to by President Trump regarding the E. Jean Carroll settlement or their verdict, where Trump was responsible for paying $83 million. Well, there has been a decision, quick decision, on one of the cases that President Trump lost. And then in Arizona, where I happen to be broadcasting from today, because I'm participating in a week-long Passover retreat, where, by the way, the level of upset and depression and alarm on the part of the 800 Jewish people who are gathered here for this Passover retreat, the concerns about what's going on in campuses are profound and deep, and we will get into them. But there is also the Supreme Court of the United States, which heard oral arguments today, including one that made headlines, suggesting that a president of the United States could enjoy immunity even if he ordered the assassination of some of his rivals. Now, there's no one in the Supreme Court who took that position, and I don't think there will be. But one of President Trump's crack attorneys, D. John Sauer, took that position. And do we have that, Jeremy? Because we can play that excerpt. That's clip number 8, where attorney Sauer for President Trump tries to convince Sonia Sotomayor, Justice of the Supreme Court, that the president has immunity to order assassination of rivals. Listen. We will get to that coming up, as a matter of fact. There is also a response from Mitt Romney, who I would have thought would try to stay out of commentary. Okay, this is the quick interchange, clip number 8.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
It could, and why? Because he's doing it for personal reasons. He's not doing it like President Obama is alleged to have done it, to protect the country from a terrorist. He's doing it for personal gain. And isn't that the nature of the allegations here, that he's not doing these acts in furtherance of an official responsibility? He's doing it for personal gain.
I agree with that characterization of the indictment, and that confirms immunity, because the characterization is that there's a series of official acts that were done for an unlawful purpose.
No, because immunity says even if you did it for personal gain, we won't hold you responsible. How could that be
the case? The fact that this question is asked about President Trump, the idea that if he becomes president again, the argument at least was advanced by his attorney that he could go ahead and order the assassination of one of his rivals. And anybody think Trump is not capable of that? Or at least that idea wouldn't occur to him, not that he would actually do it. He needs to be placed in a legal context. We will get to more of those legal developments coming up.
Medved doesn't behave himself. You can't reason with him. He's opinionated, and you can't tell him that he's wrong.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
Your outlet for outrage.
I'm not going to take this anymore.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, the argument in the Supreme Court, the oral arguments having everything to do with presidential immunity. And when is the president immune from prosecution and when is he subject to prosecution? That has to do with Trump's interpretation of the laws that govern every American. And the question of whether the president should be free from prosecution when it is used, as Trump claims it has been used against him, as a political tool to discredit him when he actually did absolutely nothing wrong. Now, of course, he believes that the impeachment proceedings against him, both of them, were the same thing, where president insists that he did nothing wrong, and a minority of the U.S. Senate agreed with him. And yes, it was a minority. He had a total of 57, a majority of the senators who voted to remove him from office at the end of his term because of some of his activities. But one of the cases, one of the aspects of the case before the Supreme Court right now has been the claim that a president should only be allowed to be prosecuted for anything if he has already been impeached and convicted and removed from office. And that would mean that you have almost no chance for legal recourse against a president while he is serving. And a lot of people say, well, that's the kind of presidency Trump wants to conduct. There's more news today on the legal front. I'm going to try to get to all of it, but there really is so much, and it's all incredibly complicated. In Arizona, where, as I mentioned, I'm broadcasting today from Phoenix, but the Arizona grand jury indicted 18 and named Trump as a co-conspirator. This involves the election scheme to set up false electors who were not elected by anybody in Arizona. And, the names on this list are very prominent names, some of which you have heard before in other prosecutions. They include Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, John Eastman, Boris Epstein, who is one of President Trump's most outspoken spokespeople today, Christina Bob, Kelly Ward, who's former state Republican chair in Arizona. She ran an unsuccessful campaign against the late John McCain and primary campaign and others. There's also been a judgment by a superior court judge, a federal judge. It's extraordinary that it's coming at the same time that all the rest of this is going on. But Judge Lewis Kaplan, who was a federal judge in New York, as a report on ABC News, today rejected former President Donald Trump's bid for a new trial in a defamation case brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. The ruling upheld the jury's $83.3 million damage award. Contrary to the defendant's arguments, wrote Judge Kaplan, Ms. Carroll's compensatory damages were not awarded solely for her emotional distress. They were not for garden variety harms, and they were not excessive. Mr. Trump's malicious and unceasing attacks on Ms. Carroll were disseminated to more than 100 million people, he added. They included public threats and personal attacks, and they endangered Ms. Carroll's health and safety. At the end of a five-day trial in February, Trump was ordered to pay that $83.3 million to Carroll, who is a former Elle magazine columnist, for defaming her in 2019 when he denied her allegations of sexual abuse. And speaking of sexual abuse, part of the issue that has popped up in the courtroom where Trump is there and there are all kinds of commentaries about his attempt to make eye contact with the jurors who, for the most part, seem to be looking away from him. They don't want to look in Trump's eyes. He's not a happy camper. He is not enjoying this process. And Mitt Romney actually spoke at the Capitol on this issue of Trump's character and why he does not believe President Trump's denial that he ever had any questionable conduct with Stormy Daniels. Listen.
I think everybody has made their own assessment of President Trump's character, and so far as I know, you don't pay someone $130,000 not to have sex with you.
Okay, what that's about is no one has doubted what is beyond question in this particular case, which is that Michael Cohen, who at the time was President Trump's personal attorney, paid $130,000 to Stormy Daniels. And Michael Cohen says it was understood as hush money. That's why this is called the hush money case. And President Trump, of course, says that Michael Cohen is making all this up. But then why is it that President Trump gave Michael Cohen money to replace the money that Michael Cohen forwarded to silence Stormy Daniels? Now, this is on a very different level, obviously, from the ongoing case before the Supreme Court. And the reason that Trump may be happy about the outcome of this case is it makes it look like when the case is handed down, when the Supreme Court hands down their decision probably sometime in June, they will call for more exploration of legal distinctions between personal acts and official acts by the President of the United States, because most people can understand that there are some official acts that shouldn't be subject to a courtroom judgment, though, of course, they would be subject to judgment by committees of Congress and ultimately by Congress through the impeachment process. The idea that Trump is going to succeed with this is that President Trump will probably see the trial of the Jack Smith trial that is being advanced by the Justice Department on his attempts to overturn the election. What that is going to involve is a postponement of that trial till after the election. And because that is a federal charge and a federal case, President Trump could basically order the Justice Department to drop the entire proceedings. Would be embarrassing, but if he is elected, he could do that. More coming up.
Thanks for taking my call. You're the most brilliant radio talk host in America today.
The Michael Medved Show.
In the Washington Post, just put up there a couple of hours ago today, this morning, the Supreme Court seems poised to allow Trump's D.C. trial, but not soon. The Supreme Court appeared poised to reject Donald Trump's sweeping claim that he is immune from prosecution on charges of trying to subvert the 2020 election. But in a way that is likely to significantly delay his stalled election interference trial in D.C. During nearly 3 hours of oral argument, several conservative justices said they were concerned about hampering the power of future presidents or subjecting them to the whims of a politically motivated prosecutor. That's exactly what Trump has been saying. Liberal justices emphasized that a president is not above the law, which is what Trump's critics have been saying. And by the way, what the court has said in the past when dealing with court cases brought by Richard Nixon to try to avoid his impeachment, and Bill Clinton regarding how he was dealing with the Paula Jones charges against him. In any event, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, questioned that idea that if you say that a president is sacrosanct, is immune from prosecution, if his action is official, then she asked the question, what's to keep other presidents from becoming centers of criminal activity? This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, clip 7.
You seem to be worried about the president being chilled. I think that we would have a really significant opposite problem if the president wasn't chilled. If someone with those kinds of powers, the most powerful person in the world, with the greatest amount of authority, could go into office knowing that there would be no potential penalty for committing crimes, I'm trying to understand what the disincentive is from turning the Oval Office into, the seat of criminal activity in this country.
I don't think there's any allegation of that in this case. And what George Washington said is, what Benjamin Franklin said is, we view the prosecution of a chief executive as something that everybody cried out against as unconstitutional. And what George Washington said is, we're worried about factional strife, which will...
No, I'm also, let me put this worry on the table. If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office?
Okay, and again, that's assuming that we obviously elect the wrong people, which has happened. I mean, we elected the wrong president for sure in 1856 and in 1852, and that led because we elected James Buchanan in 56 and Franklin Pierce in 52. That led to the Civil War. But would any of them have been guilty of this rampant criminality being a center of criminal activity that Ketanji Brown Jackson is asking about? Well, no, probably not. But then again, no one would have suspected that right now, running for re-election, President Trump would be dealing with so many different legal charges, and all of them fairly serious. The idea that there was a conspiracy involving the producers of the National Enquirer and two rejected former paramours of President Trump, and that all of that was aimed at protecting not his family, but protecting his candidacy, which is what has come out in some of the testimony so far. Everything that Trump was concerned about was to make sure that the National Enquirer kept stories, and it was multiple stories, not one, at least three, from the public before the election. The election was the key thing, not the reactions of Melania, which people can only imagine. Justice Alito hypothesized what could happen, which he saw as potentially disastrous, if presidents don't have criminal immunity for what would be considered official actions. This is clip 6.
I'm sure you would agree with me that a stable democratic society requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully, if that candidate is the incumbent.
Of course.
All right. Now, if an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy. And we can look around the world and find countries where we have seen this process, where the loser gets thrown in jail.
Okay. The lawyer opposed to Trump's immunity disagreed. Listen.
So I think it's exactly the opposite, Justice Alito. There are lawful mechanisms to contest the results in an election, and outside the record, but I think of public knowledge, petitioner and his allies filed dozens of electoral challenges, and my understanding is lost all but one that was not outcome determinative in any respect. There were judges that said in order to sustain substantial claims of fraud that would overturn an election result that's certified by a state, you need evidence, you need proof. And none of those things were manifested. So there is an appropriate way to challenge things through the courts with evidence. If you lose, you accept the results. That has been the nation's experience. I think the court is well familiar with that.
Thank you.
Okay, and good. Justice Alito seemed to be satisfied by that response. Then there was also an interchange involving, again, attorney D. John Sauer, Trump attorney, at the immunity hearing where he had to concede to Amy Coney Barrett that several aspects of President Trump's efforts to overturn that 2020 election were private, not official acts. Listen.
You concede that private acts don't get immunity.
We do.
Okay. So in the special counsel's brief on pages 46 and 47, he urges us, even if we were to decide or assume that there was some sort of immunity for official acts, that there were sufficient private acts in the indictment for the case to go back and the trial to begin immediately. And I want to know if you agree or disagree about the characterization of these acts as private. Petitioner turned to a private attorney who was willing to spread knowingly false claims of election fraud to spearhead his challenges to the election results. Private?
As alleged, I mean, we dispute the allegation, but
of
that
course.
Sounds private to me.
Sounds private. Petitioner conspired with another private attorney who caused the filing in court of a verification signed by petitioner that contained false allegations to support a challenge.
That private. Also sounds private.
Three private actors, two attorneys, including those mentioned above, and a political consultant helped implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding, and petitioner and a co-conspirator attorney directed that effort.
You read it quickly. I believe that's private. I don't want to...
So those acts you would not dispute. Those were private, and you wouldn't raise a claim that they were official.
As characterized.
Okay. Again, that's a very important distinction because it takes away the claim of immunity for Trump from the current indictments. Coming up, the latest new indictments, 18 new indictments. Where, how? Coming up. And on the Michael Medved show, the latest series of indictments, which do not directly involve President Trump, they name him as an unindicted co-conspirator. This is in Arizona. These are state charges put forward by the Democratic Attorney General of Arizona, Chris Mays. And the grand jury in Arizona yesterday indicted seven lawyers and aides who were tied to Donald Trump's 2020 presidential campaign, plus 11 state Republicans in connection with their effort to subvert the results of the 2020 election. Trump was not charged, but he was described in the filing as an unindicted co-conspirator, which is the same status they gave to Nixon in some of the indictments that sent some of his closest personal aides to jail. I interviewed Bob Haldeman, who had been the White House chief of staff, for my book, The Shadow Presidents. And I did it just before this extraordinarily powerful individual who had been a great success in business and then had been chief of staff to the president of the United States before he went to prison. And so that's a serious matter from the past. This involves the present and the future. The charges were filed in Arizona after a year-long investigation, including felony counts of conspiracy, fraud, and forgery. That has to do with the creation of phony documents claiming that people who were not selected by the voters of Arizona were, in fact, the legitimate electors. Those accused of assisting the failed attempt to deliver Arizona's electoral votes to Trump instead of Joe Biden, the winner, include another White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows, who during a part of Trump's presidency said, we need to just have someone coordinating the electors for the states. In other words, replacing the actual electors who had been selected according to the state processes with selected electors that the White House wanted to be placed there. Rudy Giuliani, former personal attorney for Trump. Jenna Ellis, a lawyer who pleaded guilty in October to illegally conspiring to overturn Trump's defeat in Georgia. Ellis has been cooperating with prosecutors, and she undoubtedly was cooperating with these prosecutors in Arizona. John Eastman, a lawyer who helped draw up a multi-state strategy for keeping Trump in the Oval Office. Boris Epstein, who is a high-ranking advisor in Trump's 2020 and 2024 campaigns. Christina Bobb, a lawyer who kept Trump allies informed about the scheme. Kelly Ward, the former state Republican chair. I believe she's an osteopathic physician, and others. What all of this goes to is the fact that the best that Trump can hope for from any of this is not exoneration. It's delay. It's the one thing he hopes for most in terms of this immunity case. Because, again, as they report in the Washington Post, the Supreme Court could rule on presidential immunity anytime between oral arguments today and the end of the term in late June or early July. But the immunity arguments take place as Trump is in New York facing state trial on charges of falsifying business records related to a hush money payment during the 2016 election. Okay, the fact that Trump is dealing with that and he's thinking beyond the verdict or any potential exoneration, because it looks less and less likely that he will be exonerated by anything that, happens in the Southern Manhattan hush money case. He was outside the courtroom today and announcing his big plans to carry the state of New York in the election. Here's what President Trump had to say. It's clip three.
Tremendous polls came out over the last 24 hours where we're up in all of the swing states and up nationally. But one came out where we're down very little in New York. New York traditionally isn't won by Republicans anymore. It used to be 50 years ago, but not anymore. And I think we have a good chance of winning New York. We're going to give it a big play. We're going to the South Bronx to do a rally. We're going to be doing a rally at Madison Square Garden, we believe. We think we're signing Madison Square Garden to do it. We're going to have a big rally honoring the police and honoring the firemen and everybody, honoring a lot of people.
Okay, it's a difficult thing if you're going to be doing a big rally in Madison Square Garden in New York City, where so many of the decisions have gone against him. The E. Jean Carroll case and the ongoing case in Southern Manhattan. And what do you say? Chris Christie, a little bit of a flashback. He withdrew from the race, but he withdrew from the race with while trying to put it in perspective. And he said this.
George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin are rolling in their graves. If they knew that anyone would have had the audacity as a felon, which Donald Trump will be come this spring, to run for president, and that other people running for the office would be willing to support someone like that, they would have added you can't be a convicted felon to age 35, a natural-born American citizen, as requirements for the presidency.
Does that sound plausible, that they would have added, no, you can't be a convicted felon? There are many Americans who think so. And last night, there was a primary in Pennsylvania. And in that primary, Nikki Haley, who's been out of the campaign for a long time, received more than 150,000 votes. And, I mean, that's a lot of votes with no organized effort to turn votes away from Trump. She got more than 20% of all the votes in Pennsylvania. And with Biden, there was organized dissent. There was an organized attempt for people who disagree with Biden about his support for Israel to show their colors in Pennsylvania. That got less than 10%. So there was double the percentage of Republicans who were disillusioned with Trump to the Democrats who were disillusioned with Biden. And this was also the case where the Republicans voted for someone other than Trump more than 20% of the time in Wisconsin and in Arizona. And at the same time that in those states, particularly Wisconsin, they had a big effort to get votes against Biden, but it was below 10%. So this goes along with a another report showing that there's some encouraging news about this election being extraordinarily close, but encouraging news, at least according to the Biden campaign and the Robert Kennedy Jr. campaign. And then it comes down to this question of who does Robert Kennedy Jr., who is surging again in polls, who does he hurt most? And most recently, he has been talking and attempting to sound a bit like President Trump. And that's part of the analysis that we'll talk about when we go to this piece about Biden's happy polling surprise in Axios. They say a trio of recent polls shows candidacy may be hurting, among swing states, but encouraging news for President Biden. We'll also be talking to the very controversial Jim Wallace, who believes that people will not find the truth in the Bibles that have been sold for $60 each by President Trump. And this has nothing to do with court cases. What it has to do with is understanding of religion. Jim Wallace has a book condemning what he calls the false white gospel. We will get to that with Jim Wallace and more coming up in This Greatest Nation on God's